Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha. Welcome to Nature Bets Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.fm. This December 4th, 2018 edition, episode 122 of Nature Bets Last, comes to you live from Rakino Island in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and also from Westchester County, New York, in the United States. First up, we have a pre-recorded chat with Robin Westenra, my mate from Wellington in the North Island of Aotearoa. Robin is a citizen journalist who has been working on our behalf for many years. Robin's work has been posted on his blog, robinwestenra.blogspot.com, since April 2011. Guy, would you like to start us off on the show, please?
Thank you for joining us today, Robin. Your persistence at reporting evidence that escapes the corporate media is particularly impressive. I believe you're among the finest citizen journalists working today. I'll start with a question I commonly receive about my own work. Why? Why do you try to get the bad news?
Just call it the actions of a fanatic and... I haven't really, you know, for the last few years since I started it, I haven't really had anything else to do because I've become sort of increasingly sort of physically incapacitated, so I don't get out to be with my horse as often as I would like. So, passion, really.
You know, I'm frequently accused of being a fearmonger. And I suspect you get that as well. Can you respond to that?
Sorry, say that again?
Yeah, I'm frequently accused of being a fearmonger, and I suspect you receive that sort of criticism as well. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, well, just the facts, man. What I try to do, I'm kind of moving away from trying to kind of, I suppose, cry wolf and to happen and just give the actual raw data that can't be it can't be called fear mongering at all. But I mean, that's what I try to do, and
yeah,
my own opinions. Except when I say that's my personal opinion, to try and keep my opinion sort of relatively out of it.
Well, we won't keep you much longer. I just have two short questions, and then we'll let you go. How does your work benefit you, and how does it benefit others? Can you address both of those questions?
Well, the first one, it probably doesn't benefit me, but I feel sort of in a kind of drive, I suppose, just to share what I know, and as far as what the benefit for other people, well, that's for them to say. I couldn't possibly begin to judge.
You know, I think your response matches something I read Kevin Hester writing on a regular basis. He writes, activism is the rent I pay for being on the planet. So, yeah. Kevin, did you want to follow on with that and maybe ponder how Robin's work, while it's not activism in the sense that you've been doing activism for your entire life, it has its merits, its place?
For me, the activism that I've been involved in over the last 40 years has given my life meaning. And it's the most important and relevant things that I have done in my whole life, that and building genuine relationships with good, empathetic people. So if anyone could take anything from what we're doing with regard to climate change awareness and the general analysis of the unraveling of the biosphere and the re-rise of fascism, I would like young people to understand that there's so much to be learned from being involved in these courses. And the joy is that you get to meet wonderful people. I wouldn't know you two unless the three of us had been involved in this project together.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm more a scholar than an activist. I'm a writer and a speaker. And Robin, I get a sense that you fall into a similar category as me with your scholarship. Can you comment?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And the other thing I would want to say is that what I've been involved in the last sort of 8 years or so has caused me to reassess just about every comfortable assumption that I ever had about the way in which the world works. And who was responsible of that was of course Mike Rupert, and then the second person of course is you.
Well, thank you, I appreciate that.
Might have reached the same point more or less without both of you, you know. But it's been certainly an important influence in my life, and these tend to come along at the right time when I'm just sort of starting to consider something, and then someone just sort of pops along who's giving the message that I really needed to, you know, to hear. I just remember the first time that I heard Mike Rupert. I'd never even heard of him before, and then I heard him say, "It's not that the economy is a Ponzi. It's not that Bernie Madoff is a Ponzi scheme. The whole economy is a Ponzi scheme." And that it's just kind of like the penny just dropped from there. So things and people just come along at the right time.
Yeah, I agree.
Thanks for mentioning Mike Rupert. I appreciate that. Guy and I will do a special to remember Mike Rupert around his anniversary of his death next year.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, thank you for joining us, Robin. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, and we really wanted to spend a couple of minutes just thanking you publicly for your work. So thanks for taking the time to spend with us today. And thanks especially to Kevin Hester and to Robin for joining us for that brief conversation. We are joined today live by Roger Hallam from Wales. Roger has been an organic farmer for the last 2 decades. He's been an activist since his early teens, some 3.5 decades ago. For the past 4 years, Hallam has been conducting research as a PhD candidate at King's College in London, England. As an indication of his commitment to activism, Roger has been arrested 10 times in the last year. He has conducted 2 hunger strikes, and he received a jail sentence for nonviolent direct actions. Roger Hallam, thank you for your work, and welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you there, Roger? Hello, Roger, are you around? You were with us a second ago.
Okay, sounds like we're having
technical difficulties. Apparently his microphone is on mute. Roger, if you can join us, weigh in at any time.
Hey, Guy, while we're waiting for Roger to come on, you brought to my attention a reach by the UN Secretary General at the, Secretary General Antonio Guterres, where he's speaking at the IPCC talkathon in Poland, where he got up and said, we're in deep trouble. He looked pretty worried, didn't he?
Yes, he looked very worried, and he's exactly right. We are in deep trouble. Collectively, we are in deep trouble. And he points out that we face a dire existential threat, and there are already millions of people who are facing this threat on a daily basis. It's a 41 or 42 second clip that I came across just today, and it really spells out through his body language, through the words he speaks, through the look of worry on his face, he really points out that we are in the midst of a dire emergency. So, good for him, finally.
Finally. Hey, Roger, I see you're back with us. Have you got your microphone set up?
Well, that sounded like a no to me.
They're actually working on their mic now, so we'll just carry on.
Okay, let's indicate to the listeners that they can give us a call anytime throughout the show. You can call to talk to us, ask us a question, give us a comment, or for Roger Hallam of the Extinction Rebellion Movement, you can pose a question for him. You can give us a toll-free call for us or for our guests. The number in the United States is 888-874-4888. If you're not in the United States, the call-in number is 011-605-562-5119. You can find these numbers at the Nature Bat's last blog, guymcpherson.com. So if you scroll down to the bottom of the essay I posted there a day or two ago, you can find those numbers very conveniently. So, Kevin, there has been a bit of news that has come out since our last show, most notably a paper in Science Reports. Do you want to chat about that for a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. Go ahead.
The title of the paper, written by a couple of biologists, which is notable for this story, the title is Coextinctions Annihilate Planetary Life During Extreme Environmental Change. Now, it was just over a year ago I expressed considerable surprise at the word annihilation appearing in the title of a refereed journal article. And here we have it again. Annihilate planetary life included within the title of a paper. So that's pretty remarkable given the conservatism of the refereed journal process and the results that are produced by that process. In this paper, they conclude that a 5 or 6 C global average temperature rise would be sufficient in a relatively short period of time to destroy all life on Earth. No nuclear power plants melting down catastrophically needed. No nuclear war needed. All we need, quote, to destroy all life on Earth is a 5 or 6 C global average temperature rise. This is shocking considering the source.
A very similar discussion has taken place at truthout.org with Daja Males. Are you with us now, Roger? I thought I heard you. Sorry. Daja Males' most recent article. I'll just quote you one paragraph from it. One of the researching and writing about the impacts of runaway climate change, as I have been doing now for too many years, I've watched several patterns reoccur. One of these is evident in a recent warning from the UN biodiversity chief of the UN, Christiana Pesca Palma, who warned that if governments around the globe don't work to bring a halt to the loss of biodiversity and succeed in implementing and plan to do so within 2 years, humans could face our own extinction. End of quote. So what I would like to know is what people think these politicians are going to do in 2 years to rectify the collapse of the insect population.
Well, you know, that's exactly right. I talked to somebody a day or two ago on the air, and they all run together after a while. I can't remember who that was. And they were talking about the collapse of insect populations and the way that serves as the base of the food web. And they posed an analogy with the oceans, where we've known for some time that plankton, most notably phytoplankton, the base of the marine food web, is rapidly disappearing. So what a surprise. You look at the base of the marine food web and it's collapsing rapidly. You look at the base of the terrestrial food web and it's collapsing catastrophically and rapidly. And people think that we're going to be unimpacted by the situation. I can't even imagine where you can get that idea.
And all of this information is freely available in the public domain, but that's not what people are talking about on talkback radio or on the television or on the front page of the newspapers. This information, you will have to dig deep, and you won't find it in the corporate media. You'll still have to dig deep to find it in the alternative media or in the blogosphere. It's extraordinary how such a critical issue can just be completely and utterly ignored.
Yeah, more kudos to Dar Jamail for his persistent writing at Truth Out. It's been remarkable following his journey since, I believe it was 2013, that he joined up with the Truth Out group and became one of their only a few staff reporters. Really turned his life upside down, as he had when he moved from Alaska to the Middle East. And then he discovered that the American war machine, was not the most important story going on in the world. And he realized that abrupt climate change was more important than that. So he set aside his previous life, at which he had been very successful, very accomplished, moved back to the Pacific Northwest in the United States, and started reporting on the most important story in the history of our species. I think I heard Roger there.
Yeah, you've got me. Sorry about that.
Slight technical difficulty. As they say down under.
No sweat. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, Roger.
Yeah, you hear me okay, right?
Say again?
You can hear me okay, can you?
Yep, no problem at all, sir. Sure. On the Extinction Rebellion site, there are three key demands, and the first one being the government must tell the truth about the climate and wider ecological emergency, reverse inconsistent policies, and work alongside the media to communicate with citizens. What does that truth mean to you, or what does it look like to you as we're here now in 2018, Roger?
Well, it means we're in a pretty dire situation, and it means telling the nation about the feedback loops that the guy's been talking about for the last few years, and how serious that situation is, and not sugaring the pill, as it were.
And we appreciate that. As you know, Roger, I wrote about Extinction Rebellion on my blog yesterday. And as I indicated, I have mixed feelings about this particular rebellion. If I understand you correctly, and please correct me if I do not understand you correctly, but if I understand you correctly, you are interested in rebellion as an end in itself, analogous to taking right action and not being attached to the outcome. Is that right? And can you please elaborate on that idea if it is?
Well, I should say, first of all, that I'm not sort of speaking to you here on behalf of Extinction Rebellion. I'm talking to you, you know, as an individual involved in it. So I just want to make that clear. And having said that, I also should say that there's a, as you'd expect with a large group of people, there's a diversity of opinions on something that's as grave and as dramatic as whether we're going to go extinct or not. So having said that, I think you're right that for many people involved, the notion of rebelling against a psychotic political system is an end in itself, given the severity of the situation. I think some people in Extinction Rebellion do think that if there is an international rebellion against the regimes that are taking us to this this terminal end, then there is a chance that we'll be able to reverse it, while other people don't. So, yeah, there's a spectrum, basically, but everyone's has a consensus on the idea that the best thing to do at this stage is to rebel through mass civil disobedience against the world's governments.
At the very least, we could take our foot off the accelerator. So since you've been involved in this stage in your life, how dominant has the extinction dialogue become in your life? Because for Guy and me, it becomes an all-encompassing thing. You know, it's pretty hard to focus on anything else except the extinction of most, if not all, complex life on the planet.
Yeah, well, I've been thinking about it probably every week for the last 10 years. So, but as I'm sure all of us have experienced, there's a sort of, there's a period where you just try and shut it out. And I think I, along with millions of other people, have done the same thing. But there comes a point where you just can't avoid the reality of it. And I started sort of looking at Guy's work and other presentations by professors and what have you on the internet about 2-3 years ago. And I've been working on that myself personally, sort of on this work for the last 3 years. So yeah, it's become an ever more dominant theme in my life, I suppose. And I think earlier I have been doing research on other forms of activism, but I felt like personally last year that I was just avoiding the main issue, as I put it, rising up this activist network that I'm involved with. And I wrote a paper called Pivoting to the Real Issue in January this year. And that's what's led to a process of this Extinction Rebellion and what's gone sort of starting to go around the world now.
You know, you're bringing up how frequently you think about this, how it's difficult to get your mind off of it, as it is for at least Kevin and I. And that brings up a question for me. You spend some of your time in Wales, where you spend almost all your time outdoors growing food, and then you spend quite a bit of time in London. And it's difficult for me to imagine there being two more disparate places so close together, just about anywhere on the globe. And so which of those two places allows you to escape the dire thoughts in your head? Which of them allows you more comfort? I suspect you get to have the conversation few people are willing to have more frequently in London than in Wales. But on the other hand, in Wales, you get to be out there in nature. Can you sort of compare and contrast your experiences there?
Well, I should say that, like a lot of small farmers around the world, I've sort of experienced the climate catastrophe firsthand. I mean, I used to run a business which employed around 25 people, and I think it was around 2006. It rained every day for 7 weeks, and that just about, well, it didn't just about, it basically killed every vegetable that I planted outside. And it more or less destroyed my business. And the following week, a similar thing happened. And I think 2 years later, it was minus 15 for a fortnight, and it killed all my leeks. And so it just about devastated my business. And this is the same with a lot of horticultural growers who don't get any support from the state and what have you. So it sort of like concentrates the mind somewhat. And I think, like, Obviously, a lot of farmers are in denial, as we all know. But I think a lot of farmers are totally aware that the weather's just gone haywire. And because you're on the front line, you know, if you're a grower, you're basically thinking about the weather all the time anyway. So it's quite traumatizing in a sense, because you're terrified of what the new season is going to bring, if you see what I mean. And I think this is, from my reading situation, this is happening, you know, from India to Australia. You know, farmers are just pulling their hair out, really, because if you're a small farmer like me, it's just beyond risky. I mean, lots of farmers have gone out of business in West Wales, and one of the farmers that did, he said, like, you know, it'd make more sense for him to go to Swansea Casino and put all his money down on a bet, you know, than risk growing stuff outside. I think the reality is affecting everyone. And in Britain, it was the warmest summer on record. You know, in Wales, it was a record June and a record May, pretty much a record July. It didn't rain for 12 weeks this year. So I don't really grow outside anymore, because I can't risk it. You know, it's just, as you know, off the scale already, really. And it's nice being in Wales, obviously, because, you know, you're near nature and everything. But it's sort of, it's pretty terrifying, if the truth be known, what's going on. And that sort of obviously makes it a lot more visceral for me than for other people, I suppose, which is one of the reasons I'm involved in this rebellion. Because there's a feeling of there's nothing left to lose, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's not going to get any better, is it?
Right. That's right. You know, and you bring up a good point about some farmers being in denial. I suspect there's a bunch of potato farmers in Canada who are no longer in denial, no matter how they felt 2 weeks ago, because of the tremendous collapse of the potato harvest this year. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago, it was within historical memory anyway, that a similar thing happened not too far from where you live, Roger. And it caused all kinds of havoc when the potato harvest failed in Ireland. So I think, you know, this is, unfortunately, we're so far down this road, and now we have the kinds of events that are causing people to take notice. And sadly, unfortunately, the events have a lot to do with human suffering, like starvation. It goes beyond the economic realm and into the realm of actual human starvation or inability to get water, as you're experiencing Cape Town today. And, you know, the examples anymore are legion. It seems like you can't escape a day when you don't have even the corporate media pointing out that food and water are no longer something we've taken for granted.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's dire, isn't it? No other word for it. And I think what's significant, I suppose, this year, and what's significant about Extinction Rebellion is there's a critical mass of people sort of turned the corner on it in terms of wanting to take political action. And as I'm sure you'll mention, you know, there's questions about whether that's worthwhile or not. But leaving that question aside, it seems in the UK at least is a corner has been turned for thousands of people. You know, like 6 months ago, we were, you know, 20, 30 people in a room. And now there's like getting on for 50,000 people in touch with us on social media, which is quite overwhelmed us, as you can imagine. And it raises the possibility and maybe the probability that in the next 6 months there'll be a major civil disobedience uprising in Western democracies, and that's what we're working towards.
Roger, I would like to know what kind of direct feedback you got from Greenpeace after the brilliant occupation of their offices. I've been having this dialogue with my colleagues in Greenpeace and 350.org and organisations like that who have been downplaying the severity of the crisis for years. And I loved seeing you guys occupy their offices. How did they come back to you? What was their response directly to you guys?
Well, I, as you can imagine, being the professionals that they are, they were very nice to us. So, but that said, it's also no surprise that they haven't actually agreed to do anything substantive, apart from be very sympathetic with what we've done. So we will be going to see them again. I think we had a chat about it today, and that might lead to more creative action, as you might say. But I think something very interesting is happening, because like many people, I've been very sceptical of the NGO sort of sector over the last, you know, 10, 20 years. And obviously, they've been a large part of the problem, to put it mildly, really, but in not telling the truth and not taking appropriate action. But having said that, like, I think this might sound a little bit strong, but I do get the feeling that a lot of people in liberal organisations, maybe in Britain anyway, are having a little bit of a nervous breakdown around it. Because these are intelligent people, and they sort of know what's going on. And at a certain point, the pressure is going to get to a point, and maybe it is at the moment, where they fundamentally question what they're doing, and you know, potentially opt for the idea of telling the truth to people for the first time, in a way, and taking that truth seriously, which is the two sides of what we're trying to do in Extinction Rebellion, is to tell the truth and to act as if that truth is real. So, you know, it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And a similar thing's been happening in The Guardian, you know, which has been broadly supportive of what we're doing. But obviously, you know, they haven't quite got the whole picture, let's put it like that. I did suggest that, you know, the editors of The Guardian go on a two-week hunger strike, you know, to protest. And as you can imagine, they haven't got to that stage yet. But, you know, never say never. I think there's going to be really interesting political changes in the world over the next 2 years. And, you know, whether that's going to do the trick is another question. But I don't think there's any question at all that we're reaching a point where people, the penny's finally dropping to a critical mass of people, you know, on the general narrative that Guy's been outlining for the last, you know, 7 years. So I don't know if that's gratifying for you, Guy, but, you know, it wasn't exactly unpredictable, was it? Because, you know, as you and others have pointed out, you know, this is a physical process, you know, it's happening. There's no question about it's happening. So, you know, it's totally predictable. It's going to start having social and political effects.
Yeah, you know, it's increasingly obvious that climate change is happening and that we're in the midst of abrupt climate change. And then you have most of the corporate media, including The Guardian, who've conducted two hit pieces on me. And so they are willing to go part way. In fact, something missing from most public conversations about climate change is the aerosol masking effect or global dimming. The BBC tackled this topic with a video episode in 2005. The refereed journal literature includes only a few brief mentions of the aerosol masking effect, beginning with a paper by James Hansen and colleagues in December 2011. A subsequent paper published by Journal of Geophysical Research Atmospheres by Levy and colleagues in January 2013 indicates as little as a 35% reduction in industrial activity will cause the global average temperature to rise 1 degree Celsius. And this rate of change, this is what's critically important to the conversation here that I essentially never read about, that would happen within a span of 6 weeks or so. Given the inability of most studied organisms to keep up with projected gradual rates of change, I have to ask whether XR is paired up in a manner with The Guardian and all the corporate media in ignoring the profound impact of global dimming. This is a big deal that doesn't seem to be entering any of the conversations, including those with XR. Can you comment on that for me?
Yeah. Well, I certainly mentioned it in some of the talks. We've been doing this standard talk around the country, which has been attended by, you know, hundreds of people. It was 250 people went to a first meeting in Edinburgh like 2 weeks ago. And, you know, if you know anything about the UK, like no one ever, you know, you're lucky to get 15 people in a room if you're bringing up anything political, if you see what I mean. So this is pretty unknown. And I think we've to be honest, I think that there's a tension in Extinction Rebellion around these issues about what's scientific and what needs to be said and what doesn't need to be said. But we've come to a sort of consensus that whichever way you cut it nowadays, it's pretty dire, whether you mention this or not. So I think that's the orientation. I mean, the climate mobilization movement in the States, there's a paper written by some of those guys which explicitly mentions the effect of pollution. So it's there. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think we know what we're all talking about here. Is there some sort of subliminal desire to sort of maintain hope? and so people, you know, consciously or unconsciously, even people that are in the climate movement or even in XR, you know, will tend to downplay certain aspects of what you might call, you know, probable scenarios, let's put it like that. And there's no point beating around the bush. It's an area of tension, you know, of how it's going to be communicated. I mean, that said, as I said, as you well know, you can just present the sort of mainstream science nowadays, and it's off the scale dire. And I think this is maybe this is what's created the trigger, because the report that came out about the 1.5 degree limit and having to reduce, what was it, emissions by 40% in the next 12 years or something. I think that's because that was a mainstream publication. It's like, it's just sent people into a bit of a panic, really, because anyone knows that to do that, we're just going to have major political and social transformation. And I think that's probably the main thrust of what's been happening behind this mobilization.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and I sort of understand, especially with the corporate media, their unwillingness to abandon hope, because we've all been told and had it assumed throughout our entire lives that hope is unimpeachably good. That if, you know, to abandon hope is analogous to begin worshiping the devil or something like that. And so I get the hope argument, but if we're going to tell the full truth, we have to point out that reducing emissions is going to have some very untoward consequences at this point. And that's the, you know, to not tell the whole story like that is, for me at least, maddening. At least that's what I'm claiming is driving me crazy. So maybe we can switch topics here and move on to the spiritual or existential side of human extinction and where global change, warming has taken us to at this point, and what that inspires for you in terms of existentialism or spirituality, if you have any. I'd like to move this beyond the science a little bit and dig a little deeper.
Yeah, well, I think Extinction Rebellion has been very interesting in the sense that I think it's the first time, in a way, I mean, as I say, apart from people like yourself and one or two other people, to move the conversation on from a sort of dry, rational, information transfer science sort of narrative, you know, to something a lot more deeper. And as you've indicated, there's a lot of resistance and, you know, a lot of immaturity, I would say, spiritually and psychologically around the notion of having to worship hope and what have you, and not being able to connect with the many rich traditions, cultural traditions, which are based their rationale for action upon things other than hope, such as, you know, notions of tradition and guilt, duty and honour and what have you, and the whole virtue ethics tradition. And I think, so it's been interesting to see that entering the public conversation in the UK a little bit, because it never gets there, do you know what I mean? Because, as you know, the whole conversation usually rotates around, you know, the problem's bad, but we can sort it out and there's still hope, as it were. And I don't think we've broken that narrative, really, in the sense that we're saying, you know, there may not be any hope, but that's not the issue. The issue is to act appropriately, as you might say. And also, I think we've brought into the public conversation, you know, emotionality, and particularly around the feelings of grief people have, and the deep emotions of loss that people have. And that, as I see it anyway, can only be a good thing. Because I think one of the main reasons why nothing is happening and nothing has happened is because of this emotional social repression. And I think that's one of the reasons we've opened the floodgates a little bit, is by allowing these new narratives of what is going on emotionally and spiritually to get a bit of a public airing. But as you can imagine, like, they're still, you know, you talk to journalists, I'm sure you've done this yourself, Guy, and you sort of say something dramatic like, you know, we're going to have mass starvation in the next 5 years. I think I did this on Russia Today. And it's a bit like you've just suggested a penny on income tax or something, and they go on to the next question. You know, it's a bizarre sort of emotional illiteracy. You know, you've just said something that's beyond terrible, and then they just carry on, you know, as if, you know what I mean? If you, so what you've said is irrelevant, or it's just words or something, and it's quite infuriating, as we all know, you know, because really you should be sitting down and saying, you know, how do we feel about this? Because unless you can connect with the whole thing emotionally, you know, my sort of research on mobilization sort of points in this direction that you have to go through some emotional pain to be able to deal with this as a more mature human being, if you see what I mean. And I think a lot of people are prepared to do that, and that's why they're prepared to get arrested and potentially go to prison and what have you.
Right. I mean, you have to reach a certain stage of acceptance regarding the end of your own life before you're willing to take those kinds of radical actions that would literally risk time in jail or perhaps risk your life. So that's a big deal, and it's a step that most people are unwilling to take. I see the infantilization of America is essentially complete. And when you turn to the mommy state or to the daddy state for every single thing, from water coming out of the taps to food on the table to fuel at the filling station and on the list goes, well, of course, people are unwilling to take much risk in pretty much anything they do in their lives. You know, something else that came up when we were exchanging email messages was the tradition of civic responsibility. And I get the impression from you that this matters, that adhering to historical, what were considered historically normal, historical norms, is something you're interested in. Can you comment more on that, or am I just headed down the wrong path?
Yeah. I think this is, well, probably an important difference between us, but I don't want to get into a big argument with you about it, because, you know, there's different ways. There's a lot of ways of dealing with this, and I think on some level it's important to be compassionate about it, because, you know, it's actually quite difficult being alive, because you've got to deal with dying. So, you know, whichever path you choose in life, it has a certain heroicism about it. That's sort of how I see it, intrinsically, because we are aware of our mortality and what have you. But I think what Extinction Rebellion is sort of tapping into is a civic responsibility ethic, as you might say. And that goes, there's variations on the theme, but it goes something like this, that we're not just individuals, we're members of a society, and we have responsibilities towards that society and towards its maintenance. And the purpose of our being, if that doesn't sound too grand, is basically to act honourably in our life and do good. And the best way of doing that is to act in a collective way against the evils that, you know, appear in our lives, as you might say, and obviously in this case, the climate catastrophe. So that, you know, the rationale here, you know, whether or not there's hope or not in this sort of scheme is pretty irrelevant. And I think there's lots of evidence, I've sort of researched this a bit, there's lots of evidence that people that do make major sacrifices for the greater good aren't primarily motivated by hope, and not primarily motivated by outcomes or utilitarianism. They're primarily motivated by a sort of virtue ethics orientation, you know, which is, you know, I'm alive in this world to do good or to do God's will, or, you know, some construction like that. And therefore, you know, confronting evil, as you might say, or however you want to construct it, is an end in itself. It's something I do as an expression of who I am. And that, you know, whether you agree with that or not, you can't deny that enormous amount of power and meaning for people. And I think that that's possibly going to be the thing which is going to drive this mobilization, you know, internationally. But we'll see, of course. Yeah.
Of course, you know, and in pointing out that we might disagree, you are maybe tapping into American-style individualism as opposed to collectivist action. Did you want to comment on that briefly?
Yeah, I mean, I can sort of understand where you're coming from when you say, you know, do what you love. But there's a sort of, there's a civic responsibility critique of that. And it goes something like this. I'm not saying I'm totally sold on it, okay? So it's not like I'm really dogmatic about this. But the critique is that we're not individual agents with some sort of intrinsic knowledge of what we love and we don't love. We're social creatures. And there's a certain sense in which we have a duty and responsibility to our communities to take collective action in the face of a threat. So, you know, it's a bit like saying, you know, to choose a sort of uncomfortable example, you know, someone might choose to do yoga lessons in Auschwitz, you know. Well, you know, maybe you are called to do that, but there is a sense in which that objectively isn't going to do the trick, if you see what I mean. What's going to do the trick is basically resistance, which is what obviously a lot of people chose to do. So I think that's the problem I have with the idea of just letting people do what they like. I mean, having said that, like, there is a strong argument that we're all thrown into this world and no one can really tell anyone else what they're supposed to do ultimately. So, you know, we come into the world alone and we leave it alone and what have you. So, you know, that there is a sense in which American individualism, if you want to call it that, has a logic as well. But I think it's worthwhile sort of acknowledging that there are these two traditions in terms of what it means to be a responsible human, if you see what I mean.
Yes, absolutely. A friend sends this question for you. He's listening to the show. And he asks, how are the more mainstream climate groups in the UK responding to XR? Are they willing to join you, or are they sitting on the sidelines watching to see what happens?
Yeah, well, as I said, probably the latter.
Yeah.
But I think it'd be fair to say that there's a lot of soul searching going on as well. And that's actually surprised me in a way, because I was sort of expecting the conventional NGOs to be largely hostile, because after all, we're sort of stealing their funder to a certain extent. And, you know, it's just a human, you know, one of the less attractive things about humans is they tend to be jealous of other people's success, if you see what I mean. So you sort of, this goes with the territory. And I've learned to expect that through the activism I've done, because I've done lots of things that are quite innovative, as it were. And, you know, suggesting people get arrested or go to prison, this is quite a controversial new sort of logic. And as you know, for the last 30 years, the main rationale is, you know, we'll be fine. We just need to, you know, pay our sub to the NGOs, send a few emails, go on a march every now and again, and, you know, everything will sort itself out. Leave it up to you, us, we're the experts. And I'm not necessarily saying that's, you know, totally ineffective, but it certainly has been shown to be utterly and abjectly ineffective over the last 20 years, as we all know, because the emissions have gone up, what, 60% since 1990. So I think for many of the people involved in these organisations, they're going through a bit of an existential crisis, as you might say, of what exactly is the point of Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, you know, these organisations in a time of climate catastrophe. And this has happened many times in history where, you know, reformist organisations have tried to keep the game going, as it were, but we just need to, you know, use information and be reasonable and everything will turn out okay. And then there comes a point where a revolutionary movement comes along and says, well, that actually objectively isn't going to do the trick and we've got a different method of change. And in our case, that's through mass participation, civil disobedience. So, yeah, you can expect a lot of sparks and soul searching to continue over the next year or so.
I believe that the Extinction Rebellion has had an immediate positive effect. The bar has been lifted. We are now speaking, we're now talking about extinction. You know, that was almost frowned upon in ecological circles because, you know, it was talking about the game being up or potentially being up. But now you've got huge communities talking about extinction. I think that you've been spectacularly successful in a very short period of time.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you know, obviously you haven't brought down any governments, as it were, but I think in terms of the what was called the Overton window, what can be mentioned in polite conversation, as it were, or what gets talked about on politics shows or whatever, I think this has been a massive change. And, you know, obviously, I'm sure we all agree about this, is it's a totally welcome development because whatever's going to happen to us, you know, our feeling is it's enormously insulting to not tell people, adults, the situation, particularly on an existential threat. And I think people appreciate, you know, we might want to discuss exactly what the truth is, but the truth of we're in a dire situation or worse is basically up there, you know, and millions of people are talking about it now. And whatever happens, at least there's a bit more grace, as you might say, in the situation. You know, we're not in this ugly situation of total denial. And that only has to be a good thing. And I think when we've done these talks, you know, people have been in tears, you know, they've been very emotional. And I think a part of it is that people sort of know, they sort of know what's going on. And then suddenly someone's got the courage to actually stand up and say it, you know, in a town hall. And it's there, you know, it's in front of them. It's like they've finally gone to the doctor and been told they've got cancer, you know. It's like there's a certain relief. And as I said, you know, this isn't some dry political process. This is a massively emotional, you know, collective psychological sort of thing that's going on here.
Yeah, you bring up an excellent point. And, you know, my friend asked a question. He followed up. He asked a question because in 2014, when he was carrying signs and making a lot of racket in New York City with the People's Climate March and so on, any mention of human extinction was met with immediate disdain. The large groups, such as he didn't name 350.org, but I suspect they were in on this side of the story, they just pushed back. No, humans are not going to go extinct. The situation is dire, but if we start right now and do these 37 things, it's all going to be fine. And I get the impression today with Extinction Rebellion adopting the name Extinction Rebellion that that's no longer the case, that people are actually looking around and concluding that the situation is far more dire than we've been told our entire lives. So it's different now than it was then.
Yeah, and I think that combined with civil disobedience sort of it forces the issue into the national consciousness. I mean, we're very inspired by, you know, the civil rights movement in the 60s where no one wanted to talk about, you know, black rights in polite conversation, as it were. And that was forced onto the agenda by mass arrests and people going to prison and what have you, you know, with the civil rights movement. And I think it's been really interesting that, you know, we've been blocking the roads in London, which, as you can imagine, is a bit of a scary thing to do. But the response has been really interesting. It's a bit like, as I said, it's a bit like people sort of know this already, and they can't quite bring themselves to be in total denial anymore, if you see what I mean. And I think we're going to see a lot more of this. That would be my prediction. And, you know, whether it's Extinction Rebellion or it's another mobilization. But I think culturally we're turning a corner here. And who knows, you know, what possibilities that might bring up. I don't know.
That's great. Thank you very much, Roger Hallam, for joining us in conversation today. This has been a very enlightening conversation, and thank you for taking the time. Also, thanks to our listeners. Kevin, you want to take us home?
Yes, thank you very much, Roger, for what you're all doing and for lifting the bar for everyone. For our listeners, we won't be on air next month because of the holidays in the United States. If you miss our live broadcast, you can find the shows in the archives at prn.fm, the Podbeam, or at Stitcher, and feel free to rate us on iTunes. Also, you can continue to follow Nature Bat's last blog, Guy's blog, which is guymcpherson.com, for further updates, interviews, and speaking tours. And you can keep current with my work at kevinhester.live. Thanks again for everybody and to AfroZen for his music. And until the next time, remember, the dominant culture has been clever, been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last. Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you.